Okay, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning, I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Scholin. We're here today in the matter of Robert Arneson, docket number 090953. Would counsel for the parties please note your appearance for the record.
Thomas Paulsino for the appellant, Your Honor, and with me at counsel table is Glenn Burton.
Thank you.
Roland Morris for the Secretary, with me Deputy Assistant General Counsel Carolyn Washington.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
12 minutes it is. You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Castle, and may it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of the veteran Robert Arneson, who's requested service connection for disabilities of his feet and knees related to his military service. There are several problems with the board's decision in this case. First among them, that appellant was not offered a hearing before each member of the board panel who decided his case. Furthermore, that the board rejected some favorable medical evidence without any independent medical basis for doing so. And also that the board has failed to explain why some very valuable lay evidence in the record was not sufficient to show a continuity of symptoms, particularly with regard to my client's knees, ever since he was in service, such that there was a important medical question why his current tendonitis of the knees couldn't have persisted ever since it first appeared in service. The first argument offered on the brief was that in this case, which was initially assigned to one judge on the board and was then assigned to a second judge on the board for reasons which are not entirely...
Before you go into that, the credibility determinations that you may want to get into with regard to the board and being able to be there, how does that apply to the issue of plantar fasciitis?
I would say it applies to
your client. No matter what he's going to say, he isn't going to be competent to say that he had that particular problem or that it was related to his pace plantis. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that he can't diagnose himself with
okay,
plantar fasciitis.
So that issue is more, I assume, on your medical evidence.
Well, the lay evidence still goes to the continuity of symptoms in the feet, as well as the knees.
But he couldn't say it was related to the plantar versus the pace plantis, could he?
No, he could not, Your Honor.
Okay, so what's the medical evidence related to that one? If you have any argument on that?
Well,
you indicated there was some problem with some medical evidence. Does it go to that or does it go to the knee?
Chiefly to the knees, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Now, with regard to the hearing, the case was eventually assigned to a panel of three judges on the board, which doesn't happen very often anymore. The board used to decide all of its cases by a panel. It was ultimately allowed by Congress to decide by...
We understand all that. Your problem is that you had a three-board member determination. You had had a personal hearing before one judge, a video hearing before a second judge, and at that time had no knowledge it was going to be decided by three judges. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And what is the problem with that?
Well, the problem is that VA's regulations dealing with the board's rules of practice state that a case can be assigned to either a single member of the board or a panel, but that either the member who decides the case or the panel that decides the case shall conduct any hearing.
So if there's a video presentation of the second hearing and all of the judges watch that second hearing, would there be a problem?
No, that would be acceptable.
That would be acceptable. Would there was no video presentation of the first hearing?
That was a travel board hearing held in Minnesota, Your Honor.
It was also, after that, was a remand, was there not?
There was.
So you wouldn't... Are you making any argument that all three had to be at that hearing or had to somehow observe it in a video?
Actually, I'm not arguing that all three would have to be present at the same time, only that if a case ultimately goes to a panel, that according to the regulations, the claimant is allowed to have a hearing before each member who makes a decision in the case.
Okay, so your concern is that I got a hearing before the first one, that's fine. I got a hearing before the second one, and that was video, and that's fine. Why isn't the hearing before the third one satisfied by the video before the second one?
Well, it's another decision maker on the case.
Do you know if this third judge reviewed that?
The transcript of the hearing?
Do you know if he reviewed the video?
With that I don't know, Your Honor. I don't imagine he would have. The transcript, I would assume.
Is reviewing the transcript sufficient?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think every claimant has a right to make a personal appearance before a judge and to attempt to persuade the judge of his own credibility.
You started to say earlier that the board used to conduct all of its hearings in three member panels until 1994 when the statute changed. But at that time, prior to 1994, the board was conducting hearings with only one member, but then still allowing it to be decided by the entire panel. So if that was its practice when it was required to decide hearings in panels of three, why would that not be appropriate now?
I actually don't know what the historical practice of VA was. I mean, I know what the regulations used to state.
The chairman's annual report has stated so in a couple places, and he's issued a prior chairman had issued a law review article that references that they believe that 7102 gave them authority to conduct hearings as single members, even when they were panels of three.
Okay, but these aren't the secretary's regulations Your Honor is referring to.
That is correct, and so I'm just wondering if this practice that they have had since, at a minimum, 1992, does that give us any guidance to how we should proceed here?
Well, if the language of the regulation was ambiguous in some way, then I would agree that it would carry some weight. But I don't see that the regulation is. If a case is decided by one member, or alternatively by three members, and the regulation says that a hearing is to be held by one member or by a panel, which we know has three members, then there's not much room there to argue over the meaning of the regulation. That is to get into the history of what VA has done in the past. So appellant is relying, for the most part, on the plain language of the regulation. But alternatively, even if the practice was to sometimes hold a hearing before a panel, or as the former regulation said, to normally hold a hearing before a panel, one would have to ask in this case why we're a claimant who clearly wanted to appear before each person who was going to decide his case, first one judge, then a second one. Why would the board, which is charged with knowing these regulations, not at least ask why he shouldn't be offered a third one? In other words, even if the regulations don't mandate the offer of a third hearing, would it, as a matter of basic fairness, based on these facts, be incumbent upon the board to at least offer him one, at least to notify him that the panel is being assigned, and acknowledge that he had asked for hearings before, and ask if he would like to have a third one?
Counsel, as I understood your brief, the import of the argument goes to the issue of credibility. Is that accurate?
Ultimately, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. So you had two judges who had the opportunity to assess your client's credibility, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Do you have any evidence that the two of them had any dispute about his credibility?
I think it's kind of hard to say from the ultimate decision of the board exactly what they made of my client's credibility, Your Honor. I think the board decision is quite ambiguous as to what was made of his testimony and of the other lay evidence in the case. Because on the one hand, the board is accepting medical evidence that it's not clear whether the doctors involved accept my client's story about having had knee pain ever since service. On the other hand, they say the lay evidence is credible. But if the lay evidence actually is credible and true, and he's had knee pain ever since he was in the service, then how can the board accept the medical opinion for the effect that his knee pain resolved in the service and reappeared later on? And I think that inconsistency in the board decision should be enough for the court to ask here whether there was a necessity of more consideration of both his testimony and the other lay evidence of record. So I do think my client's credibility was still an issue as of the time of the board's decision.
If the if all three judges viewed the video that had been taken at the second hearing, would you be here on that issue?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that would be acceptable.
Yet we don't know if the third judge viewed the video.
That I don't know. As a matter of practice.
You're relying on regulation. Have you looked at 7107?
I have, Your Honor.
Um, 7107 allows the video to be taken, but only with a waiver. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Entitling you to an absolute right to a hearing before a personal hearing?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then the question becomes, is the board the one person or the three that you're having the hearing before?
Essentially, yes.
Are the board members de novo finding, right? Fact finding?
That's correct.
Have you looked into analogous situations dealing with a trial by judge alone or a jury?
There's some argument in the principal brief as to the power of a trial judge to make basic credibility determinations.
Isn't there a right under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to have testimony redone by a judge if he replaces another judge?
That I don't know, Your Honor.
Don't you think you should have looked at that?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I apologize.
It's all right.
If I may, you said earlier that you are relying exclusively on the language in the regulation for your argument that the panel, entire panel, needs to conduct the hearing.
The regulation and the regulation cited within that one and the ones defining the terms in Section 20.707.
Do you argue that the regulation is adding any additional concepts, language, or interpretation from the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it adds additional procedure to what's provided by statute. I think the statute leaves an open question as to exactly who should conduct a hearing before the board. And I think VA has used that discretion.
By who you mean? How many? Or who as a board member versus another panel member or what?
Yes, exactly which individual, including how many, can hold a hearing. I think it's an open question by statute that the secretary has decided by his regulation.
And you point to the language, member or panel to whom a proceeding is assigned shall conduct any hearing, as that's what you're relying on?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What level of deference, if any, do you think is appropriate for us to give to that language?
To that language or to the Secretary's
interpretation? Well, to the Secretary. Well, to the regulation, because that would be the Secretary's interpretation, correct?
Of the statute, yes. But I would say if there's a gap in the statute as to exactly who should conduct a hearing, and the Secretary has filled that gap by a lawfully promulgated regulation.
So you're arguing there is a gap, and this under Chevron, this is what we should
be?
Yes,
Your Honor.
Okay.
That the regulation should control, and that it holds the force of law, and that it's binding on the board by statute, and that the board is required to know the terms of this regulation and to ask whether my client is entitled to a hearing before that third member of the panel assigned to his case.
Building on a question that Chief Judge Castle asked you about federal courts and trial courts, several of the circuit courts have weighed in on cases regarding other agencies that hold hearings, like the SEC or the FEC, and are you familiar with any of that case law and whether people who have had hearings before those bodies were entitled to the entire commissioner's who participated in the decision to have required to have been at the hearing?
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm relying on VA's regulations here, rather than the statute or on a general due process argument. It's a specific position that I've aligned myself with, and I have to stick with it.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted a clarification. 7107E2 provides that the chairman may afford the appellant an opportunity to participate in a hearing before the board using these electronic facilities, oral or video, in lieu of a hearing held by personally appearing before a board member or panel, as provided in subsection D. And if the appellant declines to participate in the hearing through the use of such facilities, the opportunity to a hearing as provided in D shall not be affected. So are you saying the statute does not give your client the right to have a board hearing before either the member or a panel?
I think it's a somewhat, I see Your Honor's point. I've considered it a fairly ambiguous position as far as what the statute lays out. There is reference to a panel hearing in the statute, and I do think that for VA now to talk about a panel hearing as if it's an outlandish idea that it never would have considered is a little bit far-fetched. There are a number of references to panel hearings in the regulations also, including the ones having to do with electronic hearings that interpret that statute. Now,
go ahead.
Now, with regard to a couple of the other arguments, I've touched on the problem with the board's weighing of the lay evidence concerning continuity of knee symptoms and foot symptoms ever since the appellant was
in. Your position, I presume, is if you have no evidence of going to the hospital for 20 or 30 years, but you believe the veteran's credible that he had all this pain, how can you then come out with the conclusion that you didn't have something wrong with yourself all that time? Is that kind of your position?
It raises an important medical question. And I'm not saying that it's impossible to answer the question in a negative, but I am saying that if the board accepts that the pain has always been there, then the board needs a doctor to explain what accounts for that pain.
And if it's tendonitis, perhaps it wasn't acute, it was constant.
All the evidence points to it being constant in this case, Your Honor. From appellant, but also his sister's testimony and other documents of record. So for VA's December 2007 examiner to just say, I think he had tendonitis in service, but that normally resolves, and I think he has tendonitis now, really doesn't account for the lay evidence in this case. And if the board really does think the lay evidence is credible, as opposed to just paying it lip service as an afterthought as part of its analysis, then its decision can't stand. There needs to be further investigation of why that pain persisted. And also I would add that the board rejected my client's chiropractor's diagnosis of early degenerative joint disease for lack of x-ray evidence of that.
Well, also in the face of x-ray evidence that didn't show it.
Well, I would add that
6 months earlier.
I would add that in the last page of that examiner's report, there's a report of the x-rays as interpreted by a radiologist. But the December 2007 examiner's diagnosis is bilateral knee tendonitis with DJD.
And the what record site?
89, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Why don't you just explain why somebody can have a statutory right to a hearing before a board member or panel, as provided in 7107, and not know that he's going to have a panel rendering his decision, such that he never gets his statutory right before that panel to have or make a decision as to whether he wants a personal hearing.
Your Honor, 7107 affords a claimant the right to have every member who does participate in the hearing also be a part of the or 7102.
Well, I'm looking at 7107. 7107E2 talks about video recordings, etc. Specifically says, in lieu of a hearing held by personally appearing before a board member or panel. And if you don't accept the video, you do not give up your right to the board member or panel as provided in subsection D.
That is correct, but 7107C expressly delegates the authority to the board chairman to determine whether a single member or members...
Sorry, which one?
7107C.
07C.
Expressly delegates the authority to the board chairman to determine whether a member...
Yeah, but I don't think anyone's questioning the delegation of the authority to determine you get a panel or a board member. The question is, do you tell somebody you got a board member and then ultimately you end up with a panel such that a right to have a personal hearing before the panel, which is provided in this statute, is never provided to the veteran or claimant?
There's no requirements anywhere that a claimant be afforded the right. Or
well, what is 7107E2? Take a look at it and just tell me what it means when it says personally appear before a board member or panel.
Your Honor, 7107E2 refers to the a video hearing, and it's not with respect to the original right to...
Well, why don't you take a look at 7107? I know this is quick for you, but E2, which specifically talks about the video hearing, in lieu of a hearing held by personally appearing before a board member or panel, as provided in D, and continuing on down... In 2, the opportunity of the appellant to the hearing, provided in D, shall not be affected. So somewhere Congress is talking about a board member and a panel and having a personal hearing. And this is a situation, as I understand it, that the appellant never knew he had a panel deciding his case.
That is
so how did he ever get a right to have a hearing before a panel?
In this case, he never had a right to a hearing before an entire panel.
And you're saying he doesn't have that right?
He does not have that right.
Congress has talked about it, but you're saying he doesn't have it.
Congress has spoken to it, and again, I would refer to Section 7107C and the language that Congress used. The hearing shall be held by such member or members of the board as the chairman may designate. And that language, as it was used formally in Section 7102B, was upheld by this court in Arneson v. Brown.
I just want to make sure you understand what I'm saying. Chairman can say you only get a board member. Not an issue. Chairman can say you get a panel. Not an issue. But can the chairman say, I'm not going to tell you what you're going to get so that you don't have a right to have a hearing before the panel that I'm going to assign sometime later? That's the issue, isn't it?
Yes, and it is appropriate for the chairman to assign a single member, despite the fact that a panel may be assigned to a case to adjudicate the claim.
At a later time.
At a later time.
Without reviewing a video. It was a personal hearing before the first board member, and now we have the other two.
And that's correct, and this turns on at what point in time the case is assigned to a panel. And in any event, the panel is required to review all of the evidence that is of record. And in which case the claimant's rights, be it due process or fair process, are satisfied by way of the first hearing.
But I'm sorry, I'd just like to build on something you said there. It depends upon the time when the time when the panel was assigned. It seems to me the appellant's right either exists to have a hearing before everybody that's deciding his case, or it doesn't, irrespective of whether the panel is assigned before or after hearing occurs, or...
That is correct. An appellant does have the right to a hearing, but whether that hearing, by regulation, essentially requires that an entire panel be present at the hearing, or whether the single member be present...
So it's your position it wouldn't have mattered when the panel was assigned. He could have still had a hearing before only one or two or all three members, and his rights would have been sufficiently exercised.
In dealing with the with the regulatory...
Wait, that's a yes or no question, please. That it wouldn't have mattered. The panel could have been assigned from the minute his decision or his case got assigned to the board or after a hearing was held. And the number of people that he appeared before wouldn't have mattered to satisfy his rights to a hearing.
If I can just add to it, you got three judges assigned. You already know those three judges are going to hear your case.
Right.
You only get one at a hearing. Is that all he's entitled to? He already knows three judges are going to hear his case, decide his case. Judge A, B, and C. Can he have a hearing? Can he demands a hearing. Can the chairman say you only get to hear him before A?
No, not under the language.
So it does depend on the timing.
Yes, it does depend on the timing. Under the language of 20.707, with the plain language is clear that whether a panel is required turns on whether at the
time... So if there's a panel assigned, a panel has to hear the hearing.
Under the language of 20.707, that would appear to be true, correct?
So the secretary, I'm not saying this happened in this case, but the chairman can game the right to the veteran to have a hearing before everybody who's deciding his case by delaying the assignment of a panel?
No, Your Honor, there are limited situations where a board panel, where a case would be assigned to a board panel. And the way this, the situation would include an instance such as this, but this is a unique and anomalous situation. Because the claimant was afforded hearing before two different veterans law judges, by statute, it required that a panel, that the case be assigned to a panel.
Can you point to where in the statute it says that because he had a hearing 3 years before by a different board member that it had to go to a panel?
And tied to that, what's the requirement to go back to the same? In other words, if you have board member A and it's remanded, additional work's done, and 2 years later it comes back, is there some requirement? They gave it to another board. Why couldn't that board member have decided it on his own? Just tied into that question.
7107C requires that such member or members designated by the chairman to conduct the hearing shall, with the exception of reconsideration decisions, participate in the final determination of the
claim. So if they held the hearing 20 years earlier on a different claim, that same board member would have to participate in that veteran's final decision?
No, if it's a different claim, it wouldn't be required. And at the same time, if the original board member is no longer available, that board member could be replaced. But in this circumstances, and again, this is a very unique circumstance which likely resulted from, most likely from error, that...
So at the time of assigning the second judge, knowing that the first judge would have to hear it, knowing, as you explain it, that there would have to be a third judge, what is the rationale for not letting the veteran know you're going to get three judges, but we're only going to assign one now, a second one now? What's the rationale for that? And why wouldn't both of them be at that video hearing?
Given the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, it appears that the appellant had never requested the second hearing. So it appears that hearing itself was given in error. Appellant only made a single request, and that was in March 2006, and that was in his VA Form 9. He requested a hearing. He was given a hearing before VLJ Cebulski. He was afforded a second hearing before acting VLJ Herman.
Was he actually given another notice that he could request another hearing?
It does not appear that he... certainly the
claim, so from his point of view, he's thinking there's one board member who remanded it, and it automatically goes back to the board? And somehow or another, the secretary stepped in or the chairman stepped in and said, we're going to send it to a second board member and we're going to give you this hearing even though you haven't asked for it?
It appears that he was simply afforded an opportunity for a second hearing.
And then we're going to assign a third judge to it after that?
Well, I would add that the second hearing dealt with one common issue, and it dealt with three claims that had never been adjudicated by the RO. And by operation of statute and regulations, because two judges had held hearings concerning at least one overlapping issue, it was required to be assigned to a panel, and because the statute requires a minimum of three board members, it was assigned to a panel. Appellant's rights, statutory, regulatory, due process, and fair process rights, were satisfied by way of the first board hearing. It was his opportunity to present his testimony and evidence. In fact, the fact that he was given a second hearing inured to his benefit, insofar as he was provided an additional opportunity that he had not requested to provide evidence and testimony.
But getting back to your response to my question, the second hearing, which you just stated, had additional claims that he did not testify on in his first hearing. So his right to be heard as to those claims had not been previously exercised.
Respectfully, Your Honor, he had no right to testify as to those claims because those claims had never been adjudicated by the RO and, in fact, were referred
right.
by the board in this decision.
But to say that somehow the first hearing satisfied everything when it only was to one overlapping claim, I don't think that...
Counselor, if I may.
Yes, please.
Isn't some of the confusion the result of the use of the word proceeding in 707, to quote, a member or panel to whom a proceeding is assigned must conduct any hearing in connection with that proceeding, period. My question is, how many proceedings do we have in this case?
You know, we have a single proceeding.
One.
I believe so. We have the proceeding that involves appellant's two claims, which are presently on appeal. Originally, there had been a third. And it's the Secretary's position that it is not the word proceeding that's relevant here, but it's the plain language of the regulation and its context. And that plain language and context means that whether a panel will hear the testimony is determined by at what point or at the time that the request is acted on and the hearing is held, whether it's assigned to a single board member or the panel. And I would add, Your Honor, that it's significant insofar as the issue of harm and prejudice caused by the fact that, as Your Honors have pointed out, he was not afforded an opportunity, he was not notified that his case had been assigned to a panel. The significance is threefold. First, appellant has not demonstrated that there is any inherent prejudice in the fact that a single board member doesn't hear his live testimony. And to the contrary, I believe this court spoke reasonably to the issue in Del Rosario v. Peek, in which it found no necessary or inherent advantage in live testimony. The panel members who ultimately adjudicated the appellant's claims did, at the very least, review the entirety of the evidence to include the transcript. Appellant has not shown how live testimony would have been to his advantage. Indeed, it's my understanding that he never actually said that he would have necessarily requested an additional hearing in this case.
And okay, Counselor, but let's go back to the issue of proceeding, okay? We've had an effort made at three hearings, I believe, and three separate board members, right? And you're telling me that proceeding is different than claim. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you're telling me that this case constituted one proceeding.
That is correct.
Okay. And the duty to provide the hearing was satisfied by the first hearing that the claimant had.
That is correct.
Okay. And everything that followed on to that, somehow due process got folded into the concept that it's one proceeding and he had one hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So we're talking about proceedings versus claims and other hearings, right?
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
So I just want to follow it up. So you have a hearing before the board, whether it's one or a panel. You have a hearing. The board remands it. Additional evidence is gathered. A subsequent statement of the case, I assume, is issued. Is he entitled to another board hearing or not?
He is. is not entitled to it.
He's not?
No.
So he gets one hearing on evidence that's developed inadequately by the secretary. It's then further developed, and he gets no other hearing?
He may request another hearing. And
does he have a right to another hearing or not?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't believe that he's entitled to an additional hearing.
If I look at 7107.3b, it says the board shall decide any appeal only after affording the appellant an opportunity for a hearing. So is an appeal each time the case is at the board? As in this time, you know, let's even just stick with the same claim. If the claim, as in Judge Castle's example, is remanded and comes back up with new evidence and arguments, is that a separate appeal or is that the same appeal?
I believe it is an appeal of the same claim.
Right, but for the 7107.3b purposes, is it decide any appeal only after affording an appellant opportunity for a hearing? Would that be, he got one, you know, as you were saying, he gets one hearing ever, or he could ask for a hearing but VA could reject him?
I'm uncertain as to the answer, but regardless, in this case, there is no evidence that he had ever requested any additional hearings. So whether he would have been entitled to a hearing had he made a request.
Is there evidence he got notice he could request one? I think it's totally lacking everywhere, isn't it?
May, Your Honor.
I mean, you can have a... Yeah, no, never mind.
I'd like to sort of shift gears, which may not fit with your schema that you've argued, but to something that I discussed with Helen's counsel. As I was stating, I found that in 1992, the then board chairman said that hearings would be conducted by one member of a panel, or could be conducted by one member of a panel in a move to expedite processing of hearings. So that your argument is that that is not the agency's position now?
Your Honor, the Secretary would submit that it is still within the authority of the Secretary to choose that course of action. However, 20.707 adds that the Secretary's requirement or the Board's procedure that if a case is assigned to a panel and a request for a hearing is acted on, then the panel will be present at the hearing. However,
and the way you interpret that is all three members of the panel.
If at the time the request is acted on and the hearing is held, correct, that would be a hearing before the entire panel at one time. However, it is certainly, and I believe Your Honor's reference to the January 1992 instruction by the chairman, I believe that it is still within the chairman's authority or the secretary's authority to conduct single member hearings. And I would note that not only has that been the consistent practice of the agency since 1992, nothing has ever changed insofar as the secretary's position on that matter, but even as well now, where reconsideration is granted and reconsideration requires a panel decision, even then the regulations provide that a hearing on reconsideration may be conducted by a single board member. And so it would be both the historic and the current practice of the secretary to regard only a single board member as necessary.
What do you call the body that is conducting the reconsideration? Is that a panel?
A reconsideration panel.
And so they are not a member or panel under 20.700 before which all three members have to appear. I'm just trying to reconcile your interpretation of the term panel in reconsideration panel and 20.700.
It, Insofar as, Your Honor, and I apologize, I'm not entirely sure that I understand the question, but
if I can clarify then, I believe you have said to us that if a case is assigned to a panel at the time that a hearing is to be acted on, that that means the entire panel has to be present at the hearing. Did you not mean to say that, or did I mishear you?
As to a reconsideration?
No, as to just a regular hearing.
As to a regular hearing, yes. If at the time a request is acted on, and
it is known that a panel...
And at that time, the case has already been assigned to a panel.
Yes.
At that time, yes, the entire panel. Under 20.707, Your Honor, and I apologize, but 20.707 explicitly refers to panels assigned under Section 19.3. Not the requirement with respect to panel.
So the language in 7107C that you told me was the basis for your understanding of that the entire panel has to be there for a regular hearing would not govern the reconsideration proceedings.
No, I apologize. If Your Honor just mentioned 7107,
yes.
the statute provides that it's within the discretion of the board chairman to determine who will participate in a hearing. It's only under 20.707, which I would add, Your Honor, in context, is part of the rules, the board's rules of practice, and it's only under that language that the chairman that the secretary has asserted that. If a case is assigned to a panel.
Okay, that's helpful to clarify your position. So if I can just restate to make sure I understand the Secretary's position, that 7107C leaves the discretion to the chairman on whether one member, two members, or three members need to be at a hearing. But the Secretary has chosen through rulemaking to add something to 7107 and state that in the context of an original, we'll call it original hearing as opposed to reconsideration hearing, that the entire members of the panel, if it is known to be a panel, have to be present. Would that be accurate?
That is accurate.
Thank you.
Simply as part of the board's rules of practice. And, Your Honor, it's the Secretary's position, again, that 20.707 is clear on its face that this is all that's required. But more so, even if Your Honors were to find that the language used is ambiguous, the Secretary is owed deference in his interpretation. And this interpretation is not erroneous nor otherwise inconsistent with the regulation. Moreover, Your Honors, there is no other ground from which to derive any additional rights to any additional hearings, given that the appellant was provided with the hearing in September 2006. He's not alleged that he has not had the opportunity to present all of the evidence or testimony in his case. His argument is simply that he was deprived of a right because one board member did not review his testimony personally. And again, in that regard, Your Honors, I would note that first, contrary to his argument, in rendering its decision, the board in this case did not discredit appellant's statements or testimony. And to the contrary, it merely evaluated those statements against other objective medical evidence. And certainly, the board's weighing of his statements and testimony was not based on demeanor. And demeanor would be the crucial aspect of live testimony.
If I can get to that, what do you think is the purpose behind 20.707?
The purpose of 20.707, based on its language and context, would appear to effectuate the requirement that the members who participate in the hearing also participate in the adjudication, and to establish a uniform procedure for the assignment of either a member or panel to a hearing based on when the request for the hearing is acted on.
If it was not important for all members who are ultimately making a decision to participate in the hearing, why would it be necessary for those who conduct the hearing to be the ones to make the decision?
Your Honor, it's unclear, but at the very least, it would avoid a situation where two members observe the live testimony and each have conflicting opinions as to the credibility, and the case is then assigned, or the case is only adjudicated by the member with a lesser favorable opinion as to the credibility. So it would simply avoid that, and at least it would require the divergence of opinions to be reconciled. But again, Your Honor, it's the long-standing practice of the agency that only a single member is necessary, and indeed, in these reports to Congress, the Secretary did indicate to Congress that the board members who were not present at a hearing would necessarily have to defer to the member who was present as to the demeanor of the witnesses. Congress was aware of this. Congress did not prohibit the practice, and indeed, as stated, this court upheld that practice under the language of former 7102. In Arneson v. Brown in 1995. Moreover, there are other instances where there are many instances where a veterans law judge is required to evaluate testimony that was not before him or her personally, including the evaluation of any evidence given to a hearing officer at the regional office, or on a reconsideration. The reconsideration panel must evaluate the original hearing that was given. And again,
can just interject with a question. Do the decisions by a panel have to be unanimous?
No, only a majority is required. And insofar as only a majority is required, in this case, the two board members who did conduct hearings were in agreement. And ultimately, the opinion of VLJ Sullivan was unnecessary because there was no need for a third member to break a deadlock.
If a decision was not unanimous, would a dissent be attached? Because I've never seen one. I'm just wondering how it would occur.
Your Honor,
so how can we tell that the members are all in agreement is my question.
I believe at least his signature would not be attached to the portion of the decision which renders the decision. His decision may be elsewhere, but again, panel decisions are so rare that I'm not aware of.
There used to be regulations that spoke to when the decision was unanimous or when it was not. And is there any current regulation or manual or something provision that speaks to what happens when a decision is unanimous or not unanimous that you are aware of?
Not that I am aware of, other than simply that allowing for a majority decision is all that is required.
And can you tell me where that is?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I do not have it readily available. I know that it is at least contained in...
It's in the 20s?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. We'll search for it.
I apologize, but at least insofar as this case is concerned, again, a third member wasn't necessary for the decision process. A third member was only necessary as a matter of course that a three-member panel be assigned. And again, it makes sense because it fits with the want for efficient process. Had there been a deadlock, the third member would have become important, but in this case there was none. So again, appellant hasn't demonstrated how he was harmed by the fact that the third board member wasn't privy to his live testimony. And I realize that my time is ending, so I would simply like to conclude that above all else, appellant has failed to show that he was harmed, and again, specifically harmed by the failure of the third board member to show, to observe his live testimony. Again, not an issue as to whether he had an opportunity to provide all of the evidence and all of the testimony and have all of that evidence and testimony considered by the entire board panel. The board did not dismiss his credibility. In fact, it implicitly assumed him to be credible and simply evaluated his evidence against other evidence and found that it was simply not persuasive enough to establish the elements of service connection. Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, we would ask.
19.7C, decision by panel members will be by majority vote.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You do excellent research.
What about the Secretary's point of view that you weren't prejudiced because all three agreed?
Well, Pelham is aware that the court needs to take due account of the rule of prejudicial error, but the appellant would caution the court against applying it too strictly when it comes to basic procedural rights, like the right to a personal hearing before a decision maker. And it's really not clear, as I argued earlier, exactly what the board made of the lay evidence in this case. The findings ultimately are rather ambiguous as to how much weight is being assigned to what.
I'd like to pursue the appellee's argument that your client got his day in court, as it were, in the first hearing, and the second one was just basically bonus. Do you have any position on that?
Can I add to that, tied into that question? If it is remanded by the board and a supplement statement of the case is issued, do you know if there's another right to another hearing or not, tied into it?
To the latter question, there's no specific regulation pointing to a right to another hearing. A claimant could certainly request one, and I suppose the board would have to consider that request, but no specific right. To Judge Sholin's point, I fail to see how the timing of the assignment of a judge or another judge or a panel really...
That actually wasn't my question yet. I do want to talk about that later. Okay. But what I was asking more about his point, which is that you got one right to an appeal. I mean, one right to a hearing on appeal, and that was satisfied by the, I think, 2006 hearing. And your response to Judge Castle answer that question, or...
Well, I would maintain that when the case is reassigned to a panel, the new hearing right arises. But I would also say that appellant had no objection to having his case decided by the first BLJ. And if the court were to vacate...
Without hearing?
Well, with the hearing. He's always requested a hearing.
Did he request... The secretary stated that there's no evidence in the record of a second hearing request. Are you aware if that's accurate or not?
That's a bit far-fetched. The record is just empty. There's a rating decision, and then there's a transcript of a hearing. The idea that the board just ordered my client to appear for a hearing, however, is not realistic. There was some transaction that went on there, and we just can't tell what it is from the record.
Well, who has the obligation to create the record of proceedings?
Well, we can't even tell from the claims file, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not from the ROP. This is the record before the agency contains this gap. And the secretary hasn't explained exactly what the board was trying to do here or even stated why a second judge was assigned to this case. All I know is that my client has continually asked for hearings, and he has appeared for them. And the ROP at page 25 even contains another statement from him, dated 2 days after his last hearing, saying that he wanted a video conference hearing. He continues to ask, and I can represent before the court today that he does want a hearing before the third member of the panel in his case. I've spoken to him about this. It's not an argument that was invented as a make-weight reason to remand the case. It's a legitimate request from my client.
Well, let's get then to the point that you thought I was asking, which is respond to the secretary's position, please.
With regard to the timing of the assignment, the secretary seems to be conceding that a panel should hold a hearing, at least ordinarily, but to be suggesting that as long as the case is initially assigned to one judge, that right somehow dissolves. But I can't see why that would be. The case was assigned to one judge, then to another one for some reason unbeknownst to us, and then it was assigned to a panel. And when it's that last assignment that we're asking the court to scrutinize here, because it's the decision of that panel that's on appeal before the court.
Counselor, let's get back to Judge Castle's first question, which was, tell me how your client was prejudiced by any or all of this.
Well, he lost his opportunity to convince that last judge that he really has experienced pain in his lower extremities ever since service.
And the decision requires two of the three, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the two appear to be in sync in terms of their findings.
Appear to be, perhaps.
Yeah. So you want to convince a dissenter. That's the prejudice that you're alleging.
I would say it's not clear what these judges think about what happened in the case.
And how about page 10 of your brief, in which you basically concede that your client was not prejudiced in any specific way, I think is the precise quote.
I don't think that I intended to concede that if I had written something to that effect.
Well, let me see if I can get you the exact language.
I would say
a hearing in front of Sullivan was not prejudicial to your client in any specific way, using your quote, any specific way.
I think the way to look at that is that if the case was just simply decided by one judge who held a hearing, then there wouldn't be any prejudice. We're not saying that my client is not asking for more people to decide his case and to appear before more of them. He's just asking that whoever he actually decides his case, he has had a chance to appear before. So if the court were to just vacate this board decision and say, Judge Herman should decide this case on remand, or Judge Sapolsky, appellant would be satisfied. One quick point I'd like to make is a brief apology to Judge Sholin. If I appeared dismissive of the idea that there are outside authorities that would be useful here, it was not my intention. It has been my experience that looking deeper into the bowels of due process or into other agencies' proceedings is typically not favorable to my clients who are working within this very paternalistic system. But Your Honor is absolutely correct that these authorities are things I should have investigated for today's argument.
No ill intent was perceived, just perhaps lack of preparation.
I can see my lack on that particular point. I'd like to say that appellant agrees with Chief Judge Castle's points about the statute of 71072. There could be a basis there for a statutory right to a hearing before a panel that appellant hadn't read into that statute earlier, but there certainly is at least a reference to a panel hearing that needs to be addressed in reading VA's interpretation of these statutes. In the Del Rosario case, the opposing counsel referred to, the claimant in that case was asking for a notice, a pre-adjudicatory notice of the value of live testimony, which I think is quite a stretch. We wouldn't go as far as saying that there is some right to notice of the value of live testimony that the court was addressing there. We're simply saying that according to the board's rules of practice, which are part of VA's regulations, if a panel decides a case, then a claimant has the right to hearing before all three of them, or to waive that right, of course. With regard to deference to VA's interpretation of its regulations, I would point to the recent decision on reconsideration in Savage versus Shinseki, where the court interpreted Section 4.2, and the Secretary vociferously objected to it in a motion for recon, asking for deference based on his historical practice and so forth. And the court granted that motion basically to make it clear that if the Secretary is going to come out against the plain language of his own regulations, he needs to bring a lot to convince the court otherwise. And I don't think that's happened here. If we look far enough into the history of VA's practices, the board's hearing practices, we'll typically find that VA has discretion to do anything that it wants. The question today is what the regs that apply as of the time this proceeding was instituted say. And what they say and what they've said since 1996 is that a panel shall conduct a hearing. And unless the Secretary has shown convincingly otherwise, I would ask the court to simply enforce that regulation. And I'll just conclude by thanking the court for an opportunity to come here today and to try to clarify these issues. And we commend the case to the court and ask you to remand all of the issues that are still remaining, particularly with regard to the needs, where my client has brought abundant lay evidence showing that he's had this problem ever since he underwent a forced weight loss regimen in service that was strenuous and embarrassing for him. And this is why he feels strongly that some benefits are due. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll submit the case. We will recounsel.
All rise.